Are you blessed or are you cursed? With a strong imagination and a spiritual thirst. Do you wanna confide about the darkness inside? Come and talk about it on Self Worst.
Welcome to episode 60 of Self Worst. 60 whole episodes. That's not that many. Look, you and I both know that I will never feel like there's enough episodes, that I've done enough, that I put these out frequently enough. Yeah, no, yada yada, the void, the hungry ghost, the bottomless pit. So this week we're talking to my friend Rebecca Fishbein. She just released a book called Good Things Happen to People You Hate. This is her second appearance on this podcast. She did a very early episode, right at the dawn, the beginning of this podcast. And you know, we've both come a long way. I just realized that I never really put out any sort of celebration on the show for the 2-year anniversary of this podcast, which was sometime in September. I just completely missed my own podcast birthday. Oh well. You know, what are we for milestones on this show? Time is nebulous. But we do talk about milestones a lot in this episode. We talk about turning 30 and you know, your first book, and you know, just big moments and wanting to go back to the past. Stuff like that. It's so fucking, I don't know if you can hear this, but it is so windy. And of course, you know, out here in Red Hook, out on the water, it's just like a wind shear, just blasts against the backside of this building, which is where I record. And the windows to this building, I think are original. They're just bullshit. And the wind comes whistling through, and I hope it's not distracting. I hope that it adds kind of a nice spooky castle ambiance. It's very on brand, on theme for Halloween. That's about it. Please go to patreon.com/selfworst. Consider donating as little as $1 a month. You can get stuff like bonus episodes and dog pictures, and you know, feel like you're doing a good service in the world. Spread the word on social media, all of that. I'll do that again at the end of the show. That's about it. Please enjoy my interview, my second interview with Rebecca Fishbein. Sitting across from me once again, last time we talked, she had just gotten canned from Gothamist, and you know, it was a real kind of tumultuous time, but she seems to have landed on her feet. She has just written a book, and you know, at the young age of 30, is a published author now. Rebecca Fishbein, welcome back.
Thank you.
So we'll start off, you know, the book is called, Good Things Happen to People You Hate, and it's a collection of essays, and, you know, talk a little bit more about, you know, just, what brought you to it and what it's about.
Sure. So it's a collection of essays that are sort of hinged on stories about bad luck. It turns out when you get laid off publicly, people sometimes come to you and ask you if you have ever thought of writing a book, and that's really what happened with me. And I said yes, and whether that was a good decision or not, I'm not sure, but we'll find out.
You got a book out of it, you know.
I did get a book out of it. I still don't have a job, but, sure. You know, I'm available for hire. But maybe after you read this, you will not want to. I was sat down with an agent, and we talked about ideas for a proposal, and we put a proposal together, and I knew somebody at HarperCollins, so I think that gave me a big bump. HarperCollins bought the proposal, and then really the book kind of just I don't really know how I wrote it. I think, you know, I just started putting words to pages, and it turned into a whole book with a lot of edits. I mean, I went through a few rounds of edits, but yeah, there are really just, I think, essays about bad things that happen, and they're not always, you know, really bad things. Some of them are just like tiny spates of bad luck.
Right.
I got bed bugs again while writing this, so I wrote a whole essay about bed bugs that was not in a...
Jesus Christ. How many times have you had bed bugs?
Four times. Well, yes, four times.
Do you have bed bugs right now? You
can tell. I do not have bed bugs now. And I get bites, so I would know.
Right.
I'm so sorry.
I've somehow never had it, and maybe I shouldn't say that, you know?
I feel like it's like having, like, strep throat. Like, if you've never had it, you'll
If you're prone to it, you're prone to it.
I think they find me. Like, they love my sweet blood. I don't know. It's horrible. But, yeah, so, I mean, stuff happened while I was writing this book, and that ended up in the book, and there was just stuff that I had been, like, thinking about, whenever, I mean, it really threw it all up, and now it's a book. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
When did you start writing it about?
I mean, I will say, actually, a significant portion of this comes from my very detailed journals that I started writing when I was 9. So,
wow.
So you could really say it's been that long in the making. I wrote the first essay in, like, from beginning to end in December 2017. And I think that actually might have been this one.
The one, we're going to, yeah, she's pointing. We're going to have her read one of the chapters out of the book.
Sorry, I'm very tired.
As a little preview, but that's okay. My next question was going to be, you know, how's it been? The book just came out yesterday.
Yes.
I imagine it's been a crazy experience.
Yeah. I mean, I guess having a book come out, my editor described it as it's a little bit like getting, it's a little bit anticlimactic, because it just, like, you know, it comes out and then it right. exists. I was really, really anxious for a few weeks about it coming out and it not selling and everybody hating it and everybody hating me. And also, like, why do I care so much about this? Because the world is on fire and I'm being really selfish. So, yeah, it's been cool. People seem to like it, so that's good. A couple of places ran excerpts, which is cool. Jezebel ran an excerpt, and then Insider ran one today. I have two events next week. I'm going to Vegas tomorrow morning for a book festival.
Famous literary city, Las Vegas.
I mean, this sounds like it's a cool festival. I think Marlon James is the keynote speaker, and like some other writers that I like are going to be there. So I'm a little nervous. My friend is actually meeting me there because she lives in Seattle and she really wanted to come see me speak. So she's going to Vegas. But yeah, so it's been a little bit of a whirlwind. I'm really tired. I also work nights. So I worked, you know, 3 nights this week and didn't sleep much. But yeah, hopefully I make some sense in this podcast and in speaking.
So far.
Yeah, great.
So far. What's your night job?
I blog for Jezebel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I used to blog also for Splinter, may it rest in peace.
Right.
So that's the second publication I've worked at that's folded on me. Yeah, so I write for Jez. And
you're like the kiss of death.
You know, the week that Gothamist shut down, the first paper I worked at also shut down, which was Baltimore City Paper. So I might be the kiss of death, but I also just think that that's like...
You might just also be in a dying industry.
I happen to be in a dying industry. There are people who are like, every single place I have worked has shut down. Like,
right.
Yeah, but it definitely was a weird trip when Splinter shut down, because I was like... I mean, I only worked one night a week, so it wasn't the same, but...
Such is the life and career of a millennial.
Yeah, getting laid off regularly. Yeah, you kind of get used to it after a while.
I've gotten used to it. Like, yeah. I'm like, now losing my job is like, I mean, I've been at this job, you know, walking dogs for this company for a few years now. And this is probably the longest I've held down any work in like quite some time. And it's just so, it just feels so weird.
Yeah.
'Cause it's not like it's a real I don't know. It's not a fucking career job. I don't have benefits. You know, it's like, I can't picture like a kid being like, that's my dad, the dog walker. You know, like I don't, it's weird.
Yeah, but it's just a job.
It's just a job. Yeah. It's just a job.
Jobs are just things that you do to make money and you do other stuff on the side. It's not like, it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't do anything anymore. I think I just write for Jezebel and like hope that I can pay my rent. I used to work at American Apparel, and that also shut down the same month that Gotham SD.
Good grief.
And Baltimore City Paper shut down. So I am cursed, actually.
I'm really taking a huge risk having you on this podcast
I'm sorry. Okay. I mean, I don't think that you can shut down. I mean, I guess your human body can, but I don't.
Yeah. I'll either die or I'll lose my voice. That could happen.
I did come across a black cat on my way over here, so
I could get canceled.
Should I leave?
Well, I don't think I'm gonna get, probably not. I don't think I've said anything that bad on public record or anything like that. I think I'm good.
Okay, well, we'll find out.
I think I'm good. We'll find. Indeed we will. Indeed we will. Let's have you read a little passage from the book. This is one of the chapters, and it's about I don't know, mental breakdowns. Freakouts.
Truly had a breakdown. Okay, yeah, so this is an essay about something that happened to me my sophomore year of college, and it's called Don't Cry Over Spilt Milk, Have a Full-On Breakdown. I was 19 the first time I lost my mind. The summer before my sophomore year of college, I worked as a counselor at a day camp for rich kids. 2 months of breaking up sticker book fights in the baking Westchester sun had bleached my hair golden. And when exactly one man on the street shouted, "Hi, Blondie," at me, it became clear that lighter hair upped my attractiveness level from little Jewish Annie to person of perhaps fuckable age. This hypothesis was verified in the fall by the thicker-than-normal throng of collegiate boys clamoring to make out with and summarily reject me. But all things must die, even already dead cells, and by early spring, my hair had returned to its normal, unremarkable brownish red. I, of course, was devastated. So one sunny day in April, I decided to spray a friend's sun in my hair and spend the day outdoors. For those of you who are lucky enough to be unfamiliar with this demon product, Sun-In is a popular hair lightener from the hair-healthy days of the 1980s. According to the sales pitch, a few quick sprays of the chemical concoction will bring out your natural highlights just like the sun, only faster. In reality, Sun-In is pure hydrogen peroxide and about as good for your hair as pouring gasoline on your head near a campfire. The smiling blonde model on the front of the bottle has clearly never touched the stuff, because when I washed it out of my hair that night, ready to be dazzled by my newfound resemblance to Reese Witherspoon, I discovered that my typically turbulent curls had deflated to a sad, stringy, frizzy mess. They were also orange, a color that didn't pair well with my face, which turned fuchsia the instant I started screaming. After a half-hour tantrum, I went to sleep, hoping my now frazzled hair would settle overnight. In the morning, it actually looked worse. I googled how to fix Sun-In, but as anyone familiar with Yelp reviews can attest, the internet is where the sadists of the world go to freak out everyone else with worst-case scenarios. Instead of finding helpful tips for hair resurrection, I found horror story after horror story documenting other people's Sun-In disasters. "Sun-In made my hair snap off," one person screamed in a product review. "It's been a decade since I used this product, and my hair has never been the same," shrieked another. "I had to shave my head and wear a wig," bellowed a third. It now seemed that Sun-In had affixed itself to my genetic code, cursing any and all of my descendants with ruined curls. The hair forum deep dive hit me from freakout to full-scale mental breakdown. I could not sleep. I could not eat. I could not concentrate on my final exams, which took place only a week or so after the sun incident. I took hundreds of photos of myself from all angles, checking to see how my new hair measured up against its pre-Sun-In iteration. I read even more message boards and product reviews detailing horror stories about triple split ends and damaged follicles. I compared virgin strands of hair I found stuck on my sweaters to the Sun-In fried strands on my head. I researched wig shops and doctors who did hair transplants. I wrote a treacly ode to my hair for a poetry class and dramatically read it aloud to the other students. I watch my hair swirl down the drain as I dream of straight, silky hair I'll never have and never know, I intoned. My classmate said the poem was very funny. To me, my hair looked like it belonged to Top Julian Glover's decomposing corpse at the end of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, but to everyone else, my appearance was more or less the same. My friends were baffled. "You look fine," they said, as I sobbed on our dorm room couch. My parents, unsettled by my hysterical phone calls, drove from Manhattan to Baltimore. They took me to a famous crab cake place and tried to get me to eat. "It's just hair," my mother said, watching me dissect softshell through cheers. "Nothing a good deep conditioner can't fix." But rationality couldn't set my brain right or stop this. Where's the dog?
Dottie has some input.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Which, as it turned out, was imminent. In fact, the building blocks for a full-on breakdown had been quietly stacking for months. The thing about losing your mind is that it happens when you're not paying attention. Depression is like a bedbug infestation. You keep waking up with bite-sized welts of self-doubt and sadness that at first you rationalize away, tricking yourself into believing you're not sleeping enough or are under-caffeinated or just have a teeny case of the blues. Then one day you can't get out of bed. That lasts for a week. Now you've got a problem. My brain's slow collapse began, as all bad things do, with adolescent heartache. The fall after my hair turned blonde, a boy I liked made out with me for 2 months before dumping me for a friend of mine. She had been offering counsel on this tenuous relationship before sweeping him off his feet. This kind of betrayal is bad enough, but it was coupled with some minor psychedelic drug experimentation. This boy liked drugs, so I did too. And while I have no idea if the strange chemical concoctions we took actually screwed with my brain, for a time they did seem to reorganize the way I saw patterns, on the ground, in the light, and most important, in human behavior. Some experts say gut feelings come from your brain recognizing patterns faster than you can consciously process them, instead squirting out a few drops of dopamine so you can sense irregularity or danger before it takes corporeal form. My newly sharpened mind had me convinced well in advance that the girl who stole my makeout buddy was going to do it. When I voiced my paranoia, both to her and to my other friends, they told me I was nuts. "I'm also so incredibly jealous of the fact that he and Emily keep having all this bonding time," I wrote in my journal one day. "I have this stupid irrational fear that he's going to realize she's so much cooler than me and fall desperately in love with her." Maybe I subconsciously saw how they looked at each other or talked about each other. Maybe I saw him touch her arm or watch her walk away. Maybe I sensed I wasn't actually happy doing drugs and playing video games with his friends, but stuffed down that dissatisfaction in favor of snagging a boyfriend. Maybe I suspected the panic I experienced each time I stood outside the door of his dorm room trying to put on the mask that made me a person he liked wouldn't be sustainable in a long-term partnership. But it was easier to blame inevitable fate and misfortune than to admit this wasn't what I wanted, and my fragmented synapses convinced me that I could sense bad things before they unfolded. Bad things, it turned out, were everywhere. Not long after my friend swiped my paramour, another friend's father had a heart attack. Had I sensed it? Not that I recalled, but on second thought, my stomach had felt a little funny that morning. A roommate's relative was killed in her car by an oncoming driver. Had I known? Come to think of it, I had had a headache that week. I recalled an episode of the Nickelodeon show Are You Afraid of the Dark, in which a cursed camera could snap a photo of a subject and predict its gruesome destruction. Was I that camera? Probably not, but certainly I was something. In its early stages, as depression starts to seep in, everything is tinged with gray. You are still you, and your friends are still your friends, and your life is still your life, but it feels muddy and overcast, like you've relocated to the Upside Down or Seattle. Food starts to taste like air. Laughter is canned. You wake up and walk around the world like you're wearing weights on your arms and your chest and your back, and you start to wonder if things will always be this heavy. Still, you are fine, you say. It turns out a great way to worsen a brain splinter is to study the skeptics. When I returned to school for the spring semester, I enrolled in a class on the history of modern philosophy. I showed up to only about 40% of the lectures, but on the occasional moments I peeled my eyes away from solitaire, I took an interest in the works of skeptics like Spinoza, Descartes, and Hume. As a child, I had often laid awake at night pondering whether anything existed outside my own head, as normal children do. And so when I read about the cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, my already warped little cerebral cortex latched on. Sure, if I imagined my friends betraying me, it might come true, but did it even matter if they weren't real? Who gave a shit about grades if they were just a figment of my imagination? If my parents died suddenly, who's to say they weren't hallucinations to begin with? I floated on this false theory, wondering if I was just existing in a real-life version of the Matrix, my body pumping blood into a machine in an unknown robot-run dimension. Time started speeding up, sending me hurtling through the weeks and months faster than it used to, as if I were living inside a movie montage instead of real life. I was having trouble hanging on to minutes, and I started to wonder if I was even who I thought I was, if I was indeed Rebecca Fishbein, age 19, sitting in a dorm room in Baltimore, Maryland. I was just under 5 feet, with curly hair, for the time being, at least, and blue eyes and slightly blurry eyesight. I refused to correct with contacts. I had two parents and a sister, and most of the time, a midterm due. These were the facts. This was my blueprint, wasn't it? Anxiety takes the gray of depression, turns it red, and twists the edges, speeding up your heart rate and making your hands shake. Anxiety doesn't make you just make you sad, it makes you scared, without permitting you to pinpoint a cause or possible solution. Anxiety warps your brain, inserting dark corridors into your future and packing them with threats. When you are anxious, you are always unsettled, no matter how much reading of online forums or deep breathing or crying into the phone you do. If you're not sure what specifically is spiking your adrenaline, then it could be anything. Which means danger lurks from all possible angles. Just a few weeks before the Sun incident, my oldest friend's father died of complications from cancer. I happened to be back in New York for the weekend, where I was visiting a friend of a friend in Astoria, chain-smoking cigarettes and drinking tequila mixed with vodka. I woke up with a vicious hangover and a voicemail from my friend with the news. I helped her buy a dress, slept in my childhood bedroom, went to the funeral, and cried on the train back to school. And so here I was, losing my mind and track of time and dreaming of my own father going into the ground in a box. Thanks to the philosophy class, I wasn't sure if anything existed outside my shattered little head, but I did know that what I had, I could lose at any moment. The people I loved would one day be gone. The things I knew could change in an instant. They could be taken from me and never return. And my hair could turn orange and never look normal again. The problem with ceding your grasp on reality is that you don't know what's happening because to you everything feels quite real. You think your hair is falling out when it's not because your brain is broken and won't tell you the truth anymore. You think your parents will die in a car crash on their way to pick you up from school because that's what your brain is threatening will happen. You think time will start moving so fast you won't be able to see it because your brain has sped up the clock. You think there's no point in staying alive because who can live without a functioning brain? Unlike people, scorched hair can usually be resurrected, and when I got home after the semester ended, I got a very expensive haircut. The stylist had held my over-dried curls in his fist and made a face. "It's horrible," he said, before chopping off the deadest of the dead ends, then dunking my head in what felt like a vat of hair mask. Relief at last. The cut helped kill the frizz, the orange tinge stuck around for months, but it didn't quite put my brain back together, so I started seeing a therapist. We'd meet once a week at her Upper West Side office, where I'd spend 45 minutes listing all my physical ailments. "I think you think too much," she said, after 6 weeks and $300. I'd like to say the therapy fixed me like the cut fixed my hair, but it turns out depression can't be snipped away as swiftly as dead ends. My therapist told me to email her, but I never did. Instead, I went to Rome for my fall semester and let thin men holding hand-rolled cigarettes psychoanalyze me. "Bella, don't be sad. Drink more wine." After 4 months in which I exclusively consumed al dente spaghetti, my brain felt back to normal, maybe because I was distracted abroad, or because it was good for me to be taken out of my environment, or because the passage of time had given my skewed inner chemicals a minute to settle, or because gelato has some kind of healing, supernatural healing power. Either way, by the time I got back to school that January, I felt like my old self again. But that old self still had some sadness lingering beneath the skin, like a pimple trying to push itself out of a clogged pore. The myth of depression is that it's something that gets better, when really it's just something that lives inside you all the time, sometimes dormant, sometimes not. My sudden breakdown might have been the most extreme manifestation thus far, whatever weird shit was swirling inside me, but the weirdness had poked its head out from time to time in my past and would certainly pay me sporadic visits in the future. It's hard to stop feeling sad when you hate yourself, and it's hard to stop hating yourself when you're always feeling sad. When I was 25, I would suffer a spate of sadness so extreme I feared I'd get drunk and try to jump in front of a subway. So I went back to therapy. Finding that marginally helpful, I stuck with my therapist for a little over 2 years until my health insurance changed and I didn't have the money or the willpower to continue. Then I slid into a fun period in which I frequently cried at bars, which was great for my friends and for all the strangers who wanted a nightcap but got my hysterics instead. Then, too, I wondered, late at night, as I waited and waited and waited for the train, if one day I'd be just the right amount of sad and just the right amount of drunk and take the leap. I consider this without any intention of following through, but when you've got the darkness in you, you can't help but flirt with the idea of doing something that might expel it into the world. For example, a few months ago, I went to the beach, and a friend offered me a bottle of something to spray in my hair. "It's Sun-In," she said. I did consider it for a second.
That's great. That is my favorite. I think that's my favorite chapter in the whole book. Chapter? Essay. I guess.
Yeah,
it's not really technically a chapter.
Yeah,
I really like what you said about depression and anxiety and comparing them, you know, or contrasting them rather as sort of two sides of the same coin, because they are.
Yeah.
And I don't really know anybody who has just depression or just anxiety. It's usually some sort of ratio of the two.
Yeah.
I think I run about 70-30 depression and anxiety. What would you say your ratio is?
I'm probably more anxious than probably I have anxiety. It's easier to tell when I'm having an anxiety attack. It's almost more acute. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's more disturbing and more sharp.
It's hard to know. Like, depression is the kind of thing where you don't even realize that you have it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll be like, why can't I do anything? Or why have I watched 47 hours of a television show? It's like you don't realize that you're just not able to function the way that you should. Like, you're not on a full, you're not, like, you don't have the full deck. Yeah. So I like being anxious better than being depressed. If you're picking, like, a favorite mental illness, it's probably anxiety for me. But
I feel like there's a lot more that I can, in my experience, there's a lot more that I can do to get myself out of anxiety.
Yeah.
Just because it does, again, I think it feels more tangible. Yeah. It feels more like almost like a, there's almost a physical presence to it, where depression can be so nebulous and almost invisible. And so I think for me anyway, like it's a lot easier for me to recognize, oh, I'm having, you know, this is an anxiety thing. And yeah. Like, I know how to shut this down. For me, my depression tends to run, and it took me a long time to even realize this, that just like rage is an anxiety. I used to just think like, oh man, I have an anger problem. Where did all this anger come from? It's like, no, dummy, it's anxiety. You're anxious about whatever you're mad about. You're anxious about being late. You're anxious about forgetting the thing.
Yeah.
Because you think that it's going to snowball in this this big snowball of consequences that's going to ruin your life.
Yeah.
And so you get mad about it, you know, because being mad feels better than being helpless, you know? So it's easier for me to deal with, but it's still, depression is the one where it's just like such a baseline for me anyway.
Yeah.
That it's hard to even know where it begins and ends, you know? So what have been some tools that you have employed to sort of put out feelers and kind of find where the trapdoors are?
Well, I hate to say it, but one of the biggest things that I've cut back pretty significantly on my baseline depression, which I also like walked around with for many years, by drinking a lot less.
Mm.
I will say that has been extremely helpful. And it's not the case for everybody, but I did January last January, and I did it for 6 weeks, and I felt like, you know, I mean, bad things would still happen, or like I would feel sad about something, but that sort of feeling of heaviness lifted.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I drink now, but like I much less, and I think that has helped. Like, I think walking around with a permanent hangover was kind of like not helping.
Yeah.
I see a therapist now. She's pretty good. So at this point, I kind of like go in and just chat. I may have to stop at some point because, you know, I think sometimes it can plateau. But that has at least helped with like general depression. Sometimes I think just accepting that it might be there is some of it too. Every so often I'll be, you know, I was like on a train going to visit my friend who lives on the Upper West Side, like maybe in February, and it was just overcome with this like extreme feeling of sadness, nothing would ever get better. And I just kind of had to sit there and be like, I felt like this before, I'm gonna feel like it again.
Yeah, accepting depression as more of a chronic illness, something that's ongoing and is to be more like treated and dealt with rather than something that you can fight and cure,
has been a big thing
for me, just realizing that like, oh, this won't go away. Yeah. You know, this isn't like an infection or something where you take antibiotics and you get bed rest and you, you know, and you eventually purge your body of the infection. It's just it's woven in, and it's just, you know, the acceptance that like this is kind of, this will be sort of an ongoing thing is both comforting and kind of frightening to me, just in terms of like when I think about like Robin Williams, you know, and I don't know if you've ever heard his Marc Maron interview. He sounds so much like somebody who's kind of come out on the other side of a lot of shit and is just like, okay, like, you know, had a lot of problems, was, you know, was like a raging drunk, drug addict, and fixed all of that and feel a lot better now, and, you know, learned how to handle my shit. And it just felt like, oh good, he's out of the woods. And then it's just like, no, oh, dog, you're never out of the woods. No. You know? And that's what's so scary to me, is just that like this is something that I'm gonna have to keep an eye on for my entire fucking life. You know? And it could always get worse. You know, and it could always come back in a bad way.
Yeah.
You know,
in a scary way.
Yeah.
About that when Bourdain died.
Yeah, that was a big thing. I wanted to say, I don't know why I'm like, oh boy. I had a Summer of Death too. Exact same year.
I think a bunch of people.
A weird Summer of Death. It was, we learned about Anthony Bourdain's death when we were getting off the plane. Caitlin and I, to go, my cousin had died. And you know, he was like 46. You know, it's hard to really know. Like I hadn't really talked to him a whole bunch, you know?
Yeah.
And, it really seemed to me my whole life from my interactions with him that he was just like, oh, he's really depressed. But my extended family aren't the kind of people who like go to therapy really, you know? And, that was a very strange trip, because while I was never super close with him, I always felt sort of a kinship and a similarity with him, just because he was such a just raging smartass and such a, just had this big shit eating grin and always had some sort of comment in his back pocket just to like, you know, and was really funny too, but was dark and kind of mean, and, you know, and was just like, oh, this is a, you know, he's a very similar kind of person to me, you know, in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, we were very different. But there was that, and then we came back like a month later, and we came back, and then a month later, our friend killed himself, and we found his body. And it was like, that was insane. And, you know, when you're... Your chapter about, you know, finding your grandmother and the sort of surreality of death and dead bodies really captured it well. Just the odd lack of acceptance that your brain has for something like that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about writing that essay, actually, because, like, the thing about a grandparent dying is like they're gonna die. Like they're gonna die.
Sure.
And it's like
in theory you should be ready for it, but I mean, come on, it's a member of your family, it's somebody you love.
Yeah, there's something about the body too. I feel like I was like a different person after that happened.
Yeah.
Like once I saw it, like there was no coming back from it. I'm so sorry to hear. I mean, both of those are very traumatic deaths.
Yeah.
Like for you, very. So I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Thank you. It was a fucked up, just tragic, you know, traumatic thing. I don't know. It was bad. And it's a weird thing, because like I also, we weren't, again, like a lot like my cousin, we weren't super close. I didn't know him all that well. I had really only known him for a few months prior. And so I didn't, some part of me just felt like I'm not allowed, I don't deserve to feel really anything from this. You know, like that I felt like kind of like a fraud or something if I felt broken up about it, because I was just like, what are you like, you know, there are people way closer to him who are in much more pain than you right now. So like, you know, don't co-opt their sadness for your shit or whatever. But I don't know. That's maybe just an extension of me just never feeling like I deserve anything.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's yeah, it, I don't know. But like it was, I felt like I don't know if I've even really fully processed it, you know? I don't know if you ever fully do with stuff like that, with like depression. It, grief is one of those things, and losing people is one of those things that's permanent.
Yeah.
They're gone. They're dead. They're gone forever. And,
there's a weird moment when you remember.
There's weird moments when it comes back. There's weird moments that make it real. You know, he lived in our building, and so we'll get his mail sometimes.
Yeah.
And shit like that, where you're just like, oh yeah, that happened, you know? And most of the time I kind of push it out of my mind. But some of the time, some of the times, I don't know, it just, it comes back almost like a compulsive, you know, thought.
Yeah.
And I'll, you know, jolt awake at night and you know, things like that. So it, I guess I'm just dealing with it like a person. I don't think I'm dealing with it any better or worse than anybody, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's okay to feel things.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I work on most with my therapist. I finally, just like a couple months ago, cried in front of my therapist for the first time. And this was the first time I'd really cried in front of like any therapist for quite a while. And, you know, that's a whole other can of worms with just me not being able to process tender emotions or sadness or fear or anything like that. Say, you know, like anything that's going to make me feel soft, any soft feelings, I'm not okay with. Anger and resentment and bitterness and all of that stuff, I can wear that out on my sleeve. But anything that's, you know, soft, squishy feelings, those are hard for me as a Midwestern male to process, I guess.
I mean, it's like a life. I mean, I don't even think it's necessarily just people with like depression and anxiety, although I think more people have depression and anxiety than but know it, but
yeah.
Emotions are very complicated, and we're taught, I think, from a young age how to push them away. Like if you're a little kid and you throw a temper tantrum, somebody's like, stop it.
Yeah.
But you're working through something, you just don't have like the language or the tools to like understand what you're working through. And so when you're kind of told like, stop it, don't cry, you're fine, you know, you don't like, I mean, I'm not a child psychologist.
Right.
I never will be. But it just seems to me that, like, it's the process of working on it. Like, I don't know. It's, you don't have to be all there. But
yeah.
It's good to talk it out and, like, to think about it yourself. When I first started seeing the therapist that I wrote about in that essay, I cried, like, every single day in her office. And at some point, she's not a great therapist, but at some point she was like, you know, you seem to cry a lot in here. And I was like, oh, is that weird? You know, like, I didn't know if that was, like, weird or not. And then the therapist that I've been seeing, I guess I've been seeing her since I got laid off, so, like, the last 2 years, I think I probably cried, like, a handful of times. So I'm like, oh, that makes sense that I, like, something was clearly amiss. Would have been nice if that therapist had helped me with it instead of just pointing at it. But, yeah, but, it you know, I mean, it's all a process.
Yeah.
Which is like the same thing with depression and anxiety. It's like trying to understand like what your triggers are, how to get through it, and that like people love you and you're going to be fine and you can't ruin your life. That is probably the biggest thing, is being like, nothing is insurmountable.
Yeah.
a thing I like to do now, which maybe isn't the best, is to, if I'm like very worried about something or I'm starting to feel anxious, I imagine the worst possible scenario. And like, I used to just do that. Like, I would just go to the worst possible scenario and spin out. And I still can do that. But I've started to be like, okay, and if that happened, would you be fine?
And yeah. Like,
I mean, I would be. Would I be less fine than I am right now? Maybe. But if I'm not dead, I'll be fine. Like, I can do it. So sometimes that's a good coping mechanism. Like, shitty things are going to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems counterintuitive to sort of, like, you know, go to DEFCON 1 or whatever and to like, to imagine, like, the worst thing. Because that's, you know, often your anxiety brain will just do that shit for you. To just like really like not let it spin you out and just like play that through and just think about that. Then it's usually not so bad, you know?
It's a little bit like when you're
It's usually you realize how unlikely it actually is that it'll unfold that way.
Well, like if you're having a nightmare, you know, like the thing to do is to like, I mean, if you can remember to do it, is to sort of like take control of the nightmare and like change it or wake yourself up. Like there are ways, like you have control over your brain sometimes, most of the time, not always. But if you can, like you may not be able to fix the feeling, but you can at least sort of try and direct, at least I can only speak for myself. And also like chemical imbalances are a real thing. So you may not be able to do it without any help. And that's also fine. But like, I have been getting better about training my brain to like sit in the feelings and like have the freak out, but not let it like destroy me. That being said, anyone who has been talking to me for the last like few months knows that I've been very, very anxious about this book coming out. So they're like, I might be like, you know, pot kettling here a little bit. But I was very, very stressed out. Turns out it's really easy to think that you've ruined your life when you like put it in a book and you're like, oh, I'm gonna give it to the people and they're gonna read about it, but I'm still here, so for now.
Right.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's like, it just sucks to be a person. Sometimes it's great,
yeah.
But like a lot of the times it sucks, and like
that's more or less the tagline for this podcast is being a person sucks.
It does suck. I mean, and I'm like a pretty, like, my life is fine.
Yeah.
But it still sucks to, like, be inside it sometimes. So, like, I don't know.
You talk a little bit about, you know, the idea of just all of this just being in your head. You know what's funny is I've never read any of The Skeptics. I don't think I've ever read an actual, like, bona fide philosophy book in my life. But every time I hear about them, I'm like, oh yeah, they were right on. Like it feels like, anytime I hear like a passage of like Sartre or whoever, I'm just like, oh, that's directly out of my head. Like, how did he know, you know? And if I was maybe like more of an egghead, I guess I would be one of those guys. I don't know. I guess they speak to a certain part of the human psyche.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I definitely felt like this. Like, when I was really little, I remember, you know, lying in bed and thinking and being like, so I know that I'm here because I see stuff and, like, I move through the world.
Yeah.
But, like, what about other people? Are they actually here? And, like, I mean, I'm, like, five. Who knows what I'm thinking? I'm also, like, Barney's on. But I think The Skeptics, and again, I haven't taken a philosophy class in over a decade, and I didn't pay that close attention when I was in it, but, you know, they really took that and they, like, played it out in a lot of scenarios, and it's kind of a scary thing to read. I don't know, there was something about being, like, 19, and, like, suddenly things feel serious.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, my life is actually gonna happen, I'm not just, like, waiting for it. That the timing of reading this kind of philosophy did not help. I also saw Synecdoche, New York around this time, which was like the worst movie to see while I was having this like spin out, because it's like, did you see it?
Yeah, it's like the Truman Show for depressed people.
It is. And it's like, you know, it kind of, it time speeds up really quickly, and like you're in this like fake, this like giant theater set, but it's also real life. But where is like, what, where are you, and like what's happening, and like why are things moving so quickly, and like why can't you hold on to anything, and like what's real? And so I'm sitting in the theater watching this movie at the Charles Theater in Baltimore, shout out. And I like go to the bathroom and I'm like, what just happened? Like my brain, like I just, it was just too much. I was too, I didn't have like the right support system to have that kind of freak out. Like there just wasn't, there was nobody around me who could be like, everything's going to be okay. My friends were like, what's going on with you? And I went to actually counseling, like one, you know, they had like free counseling at school, and I went a couple of times, and they were like, they like didn't know what to do with me. Like I was just, I just didn't have anybody to like sit down with me and be like, what's happening to you is normal. And it's like, it's not normal, but it's like, it's fine. It happens.
Right.
And like, this is just your brain. And like, you just need to like sit with it and like think about, I don't know. I don't even know how I would tell like a 19-year-old to fix it, but like, I just,
it's hard
there. Yeah.
Because also the 19-year-old themselves, I mean, at least when I was 19, I couldn't even properly express it. I couldn't, like, I knew that I felt this just intense, terrifying darkness.
Yeah.
That I couldn't fully even get a full scope on, because it was just so all enveloping. Like, I couldn't even step back far from it enough to like know what the parameters were of it. I was just like, this is just, it just feels like this just overwhelming blackness that takes over like the entire sky, basically.
Yeah, that's,
you know, and you know, I'm thinking back when I was 19, my first, I mean, I was a moody ass kid, but my first like real freak the fuck out that wasn't about just like, oh, I'm sad because like a girl doesn't like me, yeah, was around that time. And I had started reading about peak oil, and this was my first like actual like apocalyptic, literally apocalyptic freak out.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking that like nobody fucking gets it. I started going to a therapist, and he was kind of weird and like just this like very like old school guy. He looked kind of like, what's that guy's name? Jack Klugman? Krugman from the from the Odd Couple?
Yeah.
Klugman.
Yeah, Klugman? Maybe.
Krugman. Okay. I don't know. I can't think of his. I can't think
Oscar.
Of. Yeah, he's Oscar. He's Oscar from The Odd Couple. And he, I don't think that I could describe to him really the anxiety that I was feeling. And I don't think that he was really picking it up either. Yeah. And, you know, I couldn't really talk to my friends about it. I couldn't really talk to my family about it. And I felt just like, this is, I'm alone, and I feel like I'm just waiting for us to all die.
Yeah, I know that feeling very well.
And I'm supposed to like get up and go to class and like go deliver pizzas on, in my, you know, little like, you know, night job. And why? You know, and just everything, every photo I would look at of just like smiling people, and just felt like, what are they doing? What are they doing? Don't they know that we are fucked, and we're all going to be eating each other in like 3 years, you know? And yeah, I mean, that doesn't really fully go away. I guess I'm just used to it now. I don't know. I don't know what's changed. I guess just like the world hasn't completely ended yet, but I don't know.
There's something about, I wrote about this actually in the essay about the fire, because my apartment caught fire. It's in the book. But there's this, I think the fear of bad things happening is actually worse than the actual bad things that are happen. So like, I think when you've been through a few actual disasters and a few actual tragedies, it doesn't make things better because, like, the things can still happen and you experience whatever, like, pain or fear or whatever that you had, like, in the moment. But I think you're like, okay, I did it. I'm still here. Which is just, I guess, a part of getting older. But, you know, I mean, when I was 19, I was like, the people that I love are going to die. Like, that was really what was happening with, like, you know, the sun-in thing was, like, the fact that I freaked out over that is still, like, to this day, like, embarrassing for me, which is why I wrote about it in a book for everybody. But I freaked out because I was like, oh, the things that I know, I can destroy permanently. And that was really what happened, because I was just like, everything that I love and everything that I know can change at any moment, and it can be taken away, and, like, yeah, and I can't fix it. And before that, I think I was like, well, if something bad happens, it can be fixed. And when my friend's father died, I was like, nope, there are things that truly cannot be fixed. Yeah. And that was like the real moment. And it's just, as you get older, you're like, okay, yes, you can lose things and people, and, like, things can change, but they can also change for the better. And, like, I mean, grief is gonna stay with you, but, like, you will also have beautiful moments. And I think that is, like, helpful as you age, because you realize that, yeah, okay, the world sucks, and, like, we're all gonna die, and, like, maybe soon, because, like, we've destroyed, you know, I mean, there's so much existential angst that you can have, but it's also like, okay, but we can also have these, like, good, happy moments that maybe we don't realize are, like, I'm about to reference David Foster Wallace, and I'm so sorry, but,
okay.
So his way of writing, and especially, like, with Infinite Jest, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's a really good book.
Look, backlash aside, you know, yeah, like, I know. I feel like anything that gets popular for a reason, because it resonates with people, and then there's always a fucking backlash.
Yeah.
And usually I'm on the team of, like, fuck backlash, you know, like,
yeah,
let people enjoy shit. Let people enjoy David Foster Wallace and pumpkin spice lattes.
Yes.
If you don't like it, don't do it.
It is annoying, just PSA, when, like, men are like, I bet you haven't read David Foster Wallace.
Sure.
Like, I did.
That's a whole nother thing, though. That's just that's just, like, male chauvinist condescension, you know, that, like, they think that, like, chicks don't read, you know, yes, but they're so smart and tortured, like, whatever.
So in Infinite Jest, well, I think generally this is his writing style, but, like, certainly Infinite Jest, which is, like, thousands and thousands of pages, including, like, endnotes.
The longest fucking book.
So long. But his point was, like, the way that he writes is it's really difficult to get through. Like, his writing is really dense and really difficult. But
yeah,
in
it's like a one long run-on sentence, that entire book.
It is. But his thing is that, like, in this big chunk of, like, difficult writing, there are these, like, beautiful moments. Like, there's just some really funny writing, and there's just, like, that was he did that purposefully. It was like, you get through this, like, slog, and then there's, like, this, then, like, 5,000 pages of, like, description of a tennis match, and then you get to, like, a really great sentence, and you're like, that was a really beautiful sentence. This is, like, the dumb, whatever. So life is, like, a little bit like a David Foster Wallace book. It is full of, like, very, very, very difficult, dense, like, misery and slog and, like, just, I don't know, day-to-day, like, mundaneness. And then every so often there's, like, a really beautiful moment. And, like, you get more of those. Even when shit just, like, goes completely wild. Like, assuming we don't all die in a giant fire explosion. But, you know, even if it does happen, even if we're, like, eating each other and, like, living in, like, a bank and, like, hoping that nobody, you know, like, zombies are coming for us, like, we will have those moments.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I think about nostalgia a lot, and how, I don't know if it's every generation or just our generation is especially obsessed with nostalgia, you know, just wanting to dig back into, like, you know, Mario and the 80s and Pizza Hut and Blockbuster and all these sort of, like, bygone things from our youths. And I mean, you talk about it a little bit in your book about how, you know, superhero movies, Marvel movies, picked up during this time of, like, great turmoil. And the big, like, fabulous old Hollywood movies took place during the Great Depression when people needed an escape. And I think that's the same way with nostalgia, is anytime I feel a big wave of nostalgia. It's this desire to return to this time, you know, return to innocence, as the Pure Moods soundtrack, which is also nostalgic in itself. Yeah. It's wanting to go back to a time when I didn't have that on my plate, when I didn't have that looming over me, when my biggest anxiety was, you know, something like, oh, we won't have pepperoni pizza for lunch at school today. Or, you know, like a very like sheltered, nice, stable, safe Midwestern environment that I grew up in, you know? And understanding really deep down intellectually that you don't get that back, you know, that it's a forward march. And, and you can't unknow things. You can't unsee things. You have to just sort of keep rolling with it as it gets heavier. But I mean, that's been a big self-soothing thing for me, is just like watching playthroughs of video games I used to play when I was a kid on YouTube and shit like that, you know, just getting back to something and finding like a little safe cocoon for a minute. You talk about, well, you have one, maybe two essays in there that are about drinking.
Definitely one. Yeah.
Definitely one full. And it sort of runs throughout the whole book.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, alcohol and your relationship with it is like a big part of, you know, it's in the forefront of your mind, I think.
Yeah. It is.
And, you know, I don't know. You don't identify yourself as an alcoholic. I certainly wouldn't call you one, you know, like I don't know you well enough to make that call for one thing. And like, I've never seen you, you know, like freak out or be, you know, out of control. So like, but I don't think that it's that black and white with people and alcohol, you know, and people with any kind of drug, that you're either a person who has a perfectly healthy, nice relationship with this substance, or you're a full-blown, you know, junkie, addict, hopeless, you know, person who needs to go to meetings. It's, I think that there's a spectrum, and I think that, you know, a lot of us fall in the middle of the spectrum where, yeah, my relationship with this isn't maybe so good and maybe so healthy all the time, and cutting back is helpful. Cutting back or quitting this thing might be good for me. Because anytime it's used as like a band-aid, you know, it eventually that dam will rupture, right?
Yeah. I don't think that I realized how much alcohol controlled my whole life until I wrote that essay about drinking in this book. Like as I was reading through like the essays that I was writing, I was like, wow, there is a common theme in here, which is that I drink way too much.
Yeah.
And it's not even that I necessarily drank more than anybody else. It's just that, like, I mean, that I'm with, because everybody that I'm with like drinks a lot, but I could not handle it. Like, I did not know what was going to happen if I drank. Like, it's actually hard for me to remember, because I don't drink like that anymore. And then it's probably like the biggest life change, and it's only been about a little over a year since I like really assessed my drinking, but like I got really drunk on my 30th birthday, because like people were buying me shots, and like, it's just whatever. And I woke up the next day and I was really upset that that happened, because I was like, I worked so hard to not drink like this. And then I was like, it's okay. If it keeps happening, stop drinking. But it has not even close to happen since. So, I mean, some of it was just like, I'm very small.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very small. And I can't keep up with anybody. And so I would like go out with people and they would drink four beers and I would drink four beers. And then like, once I get, once I got drunk, I was like,
four beers if you're 4'11 is not, no joke.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would get really, really drunk. And it was just like, I would also like keep drinking because I felt like the more I would drink, like the more likely like something was going to happen. Like, I don't know what, like I would hook up with a guy that I liked, or like,
yeah.
I would bond with these people I was sort of uncomfortable with, or I'd have like a really amazing conversation, or like just, I would go into like in a, like something and drink and come out a different person. That's like how I sort of felt about drinking. And it really didn't work that way. Life does not work that way. I now, like, I will go to a party and, like, not drink at all and, like, have a great time and, like, have great, well, you can't really have that great conversations with people who are drinking when you're not. But, right. You know, I really just made, like, a very active decision to cut back. And I wasn't sure if I was going to quit drinking entirely. I will say I'm not very good at, like, all or nothing. Like, I can't.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, when I did the 6 weeks of... So what happened was I blacked out on somebody's roof. That was in this book. But I blacked out on somebody's roof. I wasn't with... It was like his birthday party. I wasn't with all my friends. I was like with people I was friends with, but not anyone who had like seen me black out before, which had happened. Like, I mean, I'm not going to say happened. It didn't happen every time I drank, but it happened like more than a handful of times, like in front of other people. And so I blacked out on this roof. And there was nobody around to kind of be like, you need to go home. So I was just running around this roof, like totally blackout, like who knows what was happening. And I woke up the next morning to like a bunch of text messages from people being like, are you okay?
Jeez.
And I was like,
when was this?
August of last year. So okay. August, 2018. And I woke up that morning and I like looked in the mirror and I was like, that's never happening again. There's no way that that can ever happen again. And I wrote this essay, like, I think that week. And then I just started drinking less. I mean, and then I had to be on some medication where the doctor was like, I mean, you can drink, but, like, it's a little bit taxing to your liver. And I was like, okay, well, why don't I just not drink at all and see what happens? So I didn't drink for 2 weeks, and I felt, like, great. And then I decided to do Dry-nuary, and I felt, like, even better. And I was almost like, maybe I just won't drink again. But I was also pretty bored. Like, it was boring.
Sure.
It wasn't, like, boring in, like, an, oh, I'm not getting drunk and, like, having fun kind of way. But it was, like, I was kind of not really going out, and, like, I felt really isolated. So I was like, all right, I'll start counting my drinks. So I actually put a drink, like an app on my phone. So I would like count my drinks. So I knew exactly how many drinks were too many. I would write them all down. And I kept that up until the summer. And then I stopped doing it because I was like, well, you know, I've been fine. And I'm like, it's summer. Like, I'm going to let myself like not be so controlling. And I was still totally fine. So I think like when I got used to, feeling like, oh, I don't really need alcohol to like have a good time or like be a person, I just didn't need it anymore. I mean, I still drink. Like, I had a beer this week. I'll probably have one like this weekend, but I'm not going to drink 7 beers in one sitting and then like throw up in public and like,
yeah, it would be weird to go to Vegas and remain stone cold sober the entire time. I think,
you know, you say that,
you about can't do it.
I went to Portugal and I like barely drank the whole time. We went wine tasting and I had like a sip of wine. So actually I really like going places where drinking seems like you have to do it and not drinking. There's like a weird like power. It like there's a weird power that you take back when you stop drinking as much. That's what I've found. I can say that because I don't, as much as I definitely had a problem with alcohol. I mean, there's no question. I don't think it was like a chemical addiction. So
yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, I know alcoholics and what they would tell you, I imagine, is, oh, you could stop. So you're not one of us.
No, I'm not.
You decided to quit and that was it.
That's a really important distinction because I think there are a lot of people who have like problems with alcohol, but like because they're not chemically dependent, it's like there's no, I don't know, it, you know, like don't know who to go to. Like, you're not gonna go to AA, but like you're still doing the stuff that people in AA are like getting up and talking about.
Yeah.
So
well, and it's also like, I don't know, it's like if it doesn't really ever get bad enough for you to have that, like, quote unquote rock bottom kind of moment where you're like, you know, you do something real bad that's like, oh, I crossed the line. Then you can kind of just keep chugging along and getting away with it. And, you know, it's hard to know, like, if it's actually a problem, even though, you know, in most cases, like, if you, yeah, if you have, like, an unhealthy relationship with this substance, whatever it might be, you know, cutting back would be a good idea. But it's hard to convince yourself to do that when you don't have, like, concrete examples, you know?
I really highly recommend, I know that, like, Dryanuary gets, like, a bad rap for being kind of like a wellness trend or whatever, but actually taking a month off was really good because it just, it reset me. And also I was like, I don't know, like, I probably had been drinking, like, at least a few days a week, like, since I was 18.
Yeah.
So then, you know, it's like, you don't have, like, this big extended break. You don't, like, realize that your body can exist without it. Like, I felt like a different person.
Well, and you have that negative space
that's
there that, like, used to be, you know, your time to drink, your time to smoke weed or, like, whatever. I've done this a couple of times. Not so much with drinking, just because as I get older, my body grows less and less tolerant of alcohol. Like, now I feel like if I drink any kind of hard liquor, it's over for me. Like, and that's sort of a blessing, really. Like, I can drink beer and that's pretty much it. But I can smoke weed like Snoop Dogg. So, you know, I don't know. That's a substance where you're much less likely to, like, really get ugly with it, you know? Like, it's much less likely to, I mean, you can't die from it, really. You're much less likely to, like, it's much less likely to bring out any kind of, like, dark, violent, you know, mean side of you. But it's still has gotten to points with me where I'm just like, time to take a break, because I've been stoned every day this week, you know? And then you start to realize, like, how often you reach for it.
Yeah, I think some of it is being like, I don't need this. Do I want it? Yeah. And, like, I can still want it sometimes, but, like, I don't need it. Like, I was thinking about, like, how we drank, how I would drink. Like, I would go to somebody's house to watch a movie and we would drink. I don't need to drink while watching a movie. I'm not gonna even know what's happening. Like, you just I kind of, like, stopped, you know, when I go out to dinner with my parents, I don't drink. Like, I just don't need to, and I don't want to. Like, there's just a not being controlled by something else is, I think, like, the biggest, even with, like, Gothamist, like, I that was such a big part of my identity that I was like, I can't stand without it, and then it was gone and I was like, well, I'm still here. So it was like, kind of similar with drinking. Like, I don't need it. It's fine.
It's hard. I mean, you know, writers tend to be drinky people, and New York is a drinky town, and it's hard to, when you're already I'm speaking from my own experience, when you're already somebody who's kind of awkward and has social anxiety and you know, doesn't really know what to do them with themselves or how to carry themselves, and then there's this substance that just takes that away and just makes you, like, takes the fear away. Like, why wouldn't you want to do that, like, as much as you can? But, you know, then you find out why.
It turns out, if you go into a situation completely sober and, like, have conversations with people, like, the night goes way better than when you've been drinking. That is a big thing that I have learned. Like, as long as you, like, have a glass of seltzer in your hand and go up to somebody and, like, talk to them, like, you're much sharper in conversation. You are really good at group game nights. You know, there's, like, there's a weird, like, there's a cool power in being, like, I'm totally fine without it. And I think we're socialized, like, very young to believe that, like, we need this thing, that it will bond you.
I mean, it's, you know, and, like, my experience with it is weird because I didn't really start drinking till I was, in my 20s, and I didn't start smoking weed till I was, like, in my, like, mid 20s, you know, and went through kind of a pretty adamant, like, straight edge, phase as well, which was also at the peak of my you know, social anxiety, wanting to fit in, wanting to talk to girls, and like it just was it was a real, being sober at that time just I think made it worse. I think just made everything so much worse for me. Now, you know, like that I've, you know, been through the ringer and have been to more parties than I can fucking count, and have had more of those experiences where, like you were saying, wanting to kind of continue the night and kind of keep plugging quarters into the machine, hoping that something really exciting will happen.
Yeah.
You know, hoping that, like, if I stay at this party maybe a little longer, you know, some gorgeous babe will walk in and I'll start making out with them. Or maybe I'll meet somebody who, like, is going to be like a really good network thing. We're going to start the great, you know, American artwork that we're going to, you know, build together. We're going to start this partnership, and it's going to be this crazy thing, and it never happens. And then you're just at this party forever.
Yeah.
You know,
if you're me, you're probably crying, because, you know, I cry when I drink too much. Yeah, I mean, drinking, there are a lot of, like, I think we're sort of in an era now where everybody's, like, sober curious, and, like, it's, like, the new thing. And, like, there are some really, if you do not have a chemical dependence on alcohol, there are some great things about drinking. Like, wine makes food taste better.
Sure.
And, like,
yeah.
Civilizations have been using...
Beer is delicious and refreshing.
Yeah. I mean,
it's great.
Civilizations have been using alcohol to, like, make things... Like, a lot of things wouldn't exist without alcohol, like great music and, like, I mean, like,
sure.
And, like, it's, there are some good things about it. It's just that, I don't know, like, you don't need it all the time, and you don't need more of it. Like, that is the thing that I've noticed the most, is, like, being out and being like, I'm good. Like, I've had a drink, or I've had two drinks, and I don't need any more. And, like, other people will just keep drinking, and I'm like, I can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't want to. But, you know, who knows? I could be just, like, depression. Like, you can say I'm fine, and then, like, a year later, like, not be. I don't know. Like, for now, I'm fine. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, you know, I think about that a lot, and just, like, you know, I tend to be kind of like a mental hypochondriac, and have asked myself several times, like, am I like an addict? Am I addicted to this substance? Am I addicted to sex? Am I addicted to, like, whatever? And I don't think so. I think the only thing that I could say that I'm addicted to is the dopamine.
Yeah.
It's just the good, exciting feeling that whatever it is, that I'm doing that takes me away from myself for a second. You know, and that's, I mean, I don't think I was ever as hopelessly addicted to anything as I was to, like, dating and Tinder and all of that, like, you know, sort of like thirsty texting intrigue kind of shit that just, like, that got me higher than anything, anything I've ever taken. And, you know, it's fun, but then, like, then what? Then you go on for years doing that, and then it gets to a point where you really fucking paint yourself into a corner, and you can't really form anything real and long-term with people. And then when you do, you know, you feel like you're missing out on something. You have this, like, permanent FOMA.
Yeah, you're definitely not missing out on dating.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. Is, like, when I really think about it, I'm like, ugh, God, it was so exhausting. But, like, when I think about it, what I miss is just that validation. Just the validation was, like, fucking better than anything. Better than anything. And sort of closing the book on that is a weird experience. Because that is something where it is more or less black and white. You can't really go back to you know, doing that if you're in, like, a long-term relationship. You know what I mean?
No, but you can have other experiences. I mean, there's, like, it's a two, you know, there at the coin, the grass is always greener. Let me tell you, dating is just...
Dating fucking sucks.
Just awful.
Yeah.
I think I've given up, honestly. But, yeah. No, I mean, sometimes it's good to do things that make you feel really alive.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is that, like, you know, you just entered your 30s. I'm halfway through. And what I've noticed about getting into your 30s is there's a lot of just boredom. Once you get into a stable job and there's no more like kind of crazy spin outs, you almost miss the spin out sometimes, and you almost miss the feeling of reckless abandon and adventure and stuff. And
I know, we have some friends in our 30s mutually who I feel
who are still doing that kind of stuff. I get bored, but like it's not that my life is boring, you know. Like I have a good job, I have a good relationship, I have this beautiful family, we have a dog child, and it's like when I really think about it, it's like I wouldn't trade it for anything, and yet I have these moments where I just feel like so kind of numb. Especially, I think it's mainly my job. I think it's mainly just that I'm walking the same fucking dogs the same fucking time every day.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I get to this point where you're supposed to, you know, for example, you're supposed to write these notes after every walk to the dog owner about what happened on the walk that day. And you can do it at first. But then after months, years of walking the same dog at the same time, what more do you have to say? Because it's just the same routine thing. It's like, yep, they went out, they pooped here, they peed here, like they do every fucking day. How can I make that exciting to you? I'm sorry.
No, I'm fully convinced that that's why people have kids, because like things just like they grow, so like things change, and you're like, wow, now you're in second grade, you know, like they like life happens with them. As opposed to, like, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it, like...
Yeah,
like,
watching, you know, watching somebody else sort of, like, blossom and develop when you've sort of, like, plateaued in your life, I think is, yeah. There's something to that.
That might be it. I think that's probably why my dad had kids. But, yeah, I don't know. I think I was so depressed and self-hating and miserable in my 20s that I am comfortable doing something else. And the nice thing about being 30 is that I feel like there was a definite end. Like, I'm like, okay, that's done. And I'm not doing it again. So,
yeah,
well, you know, maybe I'll have a teenissance, but I'm fine.
The book came along at an interesting time because it came out literally just a couple weeks after you turned 30.
Exactly a month.
Yeah. So, like, that's an interesting sort of coda, you know, that like you had this sort of milestone on top of a milestone.
Yeah, it was very stressful for a period of time. Yeah, it's funny because like I will even read a couple of essays just went up on, you know, like excerpts, and I was even reading the essays and I was like, well, I don't even feel like this now. You know, like things just, I mean, the best advice that anyone has ever given me was when I was very, very heartbroken over some guy, and I was just like completely destroyed. And my friend just like looked at me and she was like, things change all the time. And that is like a very simple way of like putting something, but you know, like
this too shall pass.
How you feel about something 1 minute will change, and like what's happening in your life will change. At some point you will not be walking these dogs. I don't know what you'll be doing, but like things will change. And there's sometimes something nice in having like a little bit of a respite from like change. And then being like, okay, well, now my life is upended some other way. Like,
well, that's what's so weird is like I have this sort of schizophrenia where I shouldn't call it schizophrenia, but this sort of double think where I crave some sort of break in the routine, but I also love the routine.
Yeah.
And I love the stability. I love that I come home every day. And Caitlin, in a, you know, beautiful leaning into the patriarchy, is like making dinner, and I come home and she's making this beautiful meal, and we we watch a movie and we hang out with Dottie, and there's a stability and a certainty to like what I'm coming home to every day that like, I don't know, that my crazy anxiety ridden brain needs.
Yeah.
You know?
It's nice to have stability sometimes. Routine can be really great. And there's always a break in the routine. Something always happens. Not like necessarily something bad, but just something, stuff gets shaken up. Like yeah. The time changes. I don't know. I'm convinced there's like a universal like shift. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard.
Seasons changing is really exciting. Yeah. I do like, this is my favorite season. Yeah. I used to be a summer guy. But that's just because I think I had like really bad seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah.
For some reason, it doesn't seem to be so bad now. Like, I don't get as depressed in the winter. Maybe because I get equally as depressed in the summer now.
I get anxious.
It's
in
metastasized
the
to just the entire year now. So I'm just like, oh, I don't just get sad in the winter now.
I think I might actually almost like winter. I don't like it, but there's a comfort in it coming.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
There's a coziness. Yeah. I also, this is another byproduct of being in my 30s, is I just sweat and sweat like an amphibian and just...
Man, I'm really not looking forward to
it. Oh, it's just the sweat. You won't... Nobody sweats as much as me. No, don't worry about it. It's like the sweat and my clothes feel like they're never dry. And I just feel it's just this like... Blech,
and you have curly hair.
I have curly hair.
Summer is not... Like fall is like great
fall
time
is good
hair
time.
Yeah.
What? Let's close out with some hair care tips.
Oh, yes. Okay.
What do you do for your hair?
Oh, man. Well, I never wash it. That's like my first tip.
Yeah.
I wash it maybe every 4 or 5 days. When I do wash it, I actually buy really expensive conditioner. I find that makes a difference. And I use sulfate-free shampoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I comb it out first. And I don't own a hairbrush. So it's really funny when people with straight hair come over and they're like, oh, can I borrow your hairbrush? And or they're like, oh, do you have a hairbrush? Like, assuming I'm going to say yes. And I'm like, right. No, I don't.
You can't run a brush through it.
It's not. It wouldn't happen. Yeah, so I use a little bit of LA Lux hair gel, which is not good for you. And also you have to buy it on Amazon because they don't even make it anymore because I'm pretty sure it's poison. And a little bit of mousse. And then I braid it and then I sleep on it while it's wet. And that's why I only wash it every like 4 or 5 days because it's a little bit. And then that's it. And then I just take it out of the braid the next day and go about my life for 4 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't wash very often my hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I've found, have you ever tried sea salt? You mix some sea salt with some water, maybe a little coconut oil if you're feeling real fancy, and you spritz that in your hair.
No.
And it makes these nice ringlets. You get sort of like beach curls.
Oh, my hair looks great when I go on the beach.
Yeah, exactly, right? Because really it's blonde. It's the like salty air. And like I noticed that and I looked it up and it's like a thing. People make like a sea salt spray for their hair.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. A hair tip I have is do not use Sun In.
Don't use Sun In.
I have watched my friends use Sun In. Their hair seems fine, but like it, like a piece of me just dies watching it. Yeah, that was a mistake. Yeah, so that's it. That's my hair. And I really also just let it live its life and don't worry too much if it's,
yeah,
it grows throughout the day and no one knows what it's going to look like at the end. And
yeah,
okay,
you have to
that.
Embrace the chaos.
It could be anything.
You have to just sort of let it. I tried for the longest time to just like, straight jacket it and like comb it and make it do a thing. And you can't, it's free spirit, man.
I used to gel each individual strand of hair in middle school because I wanted it to like lie flat and it just looked terrible. So
yeah.
Yeah, I don't recommend that. Just love the hair that you have and yeah, hope that you haven't, you know, poisoned it with like weird like 90s hair dye.
I did a thing for a while where I would get it wet and I would just wear a stocking cap until it dried under there and it would like have this, it would straighten it effectively. But it looks, it, you know, it's like when like James Brown straightened his hair, and it just has that weird kind of like, it doesn't quite look, it looks a little strange, like it just was like too flat.
Well, if you have curly hair, the actual strand of your hair is flat.
Yeah.
So,
oops.
It's flat, so you can never, like, I can't straighten my hair. It might like look straight, but it's also
it's not actually.
It's not the right shape. Yeah.
Rebecca Fishbein, thank you so much for
thank
coming
for
back on the
me.
Show. Obviously, you know, we're here to plug the book. It's called Good Things Happen to People You Hate. It's on Amazon, IndieBound, bookstores nationwide. Is it nationwide?
Yeah, I guess so. I hope so.
All right.
You can definitely buy it wherever.
All right.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks once again to Rebecca Fishbein. Go buy that book. It's available anywhere you can buy a book. Where do people even buy books these days? Mostly on the internet. Just do it there, I guess. Buy the book. It's really, it was a fun, breezy read. It's funny. It's poignant. And read it. Support the show financially by going to patreon.com/selfworst. Kicking as little as $1 a month. And as much as however you want. Maybe you're a billionaire and you could just give me $500,000. I wouldn't say no to that. This isn't the most billionaire-friendly podcast in the world, but maybe there's a billionaire out there listening to this. Who knows? Rate and review us on iTunes. Spread the word on social media. Tell a friend. It's great conversation starter at parties. If you're like trying to pick up chicks, just walk up to them and just be like, "Hey, baby, you ever heard of Selfworst?" And then explain to them the entire podcast without breaking eye contact. Just run through the entire thing. Tell them about the podcast. It's very attractive. I'm Brad Pearson. Music is by Shay Bartel. Thank you, Shay, for this beautiful, beautiful music. I'm Brad Pearson. Until next time, go out and fail. It's good for you.